Jimmy, Jimmy Crane, Jimmy Crane's a nerd. Jimmy Crane's an improv nerd. Jimmy Crane's a nerd. Oh,
hey everybody, this is Jimmy Crane, and you're listening to another great episode of Improv Nerd. And our guest today is Bob Fisher. He is a well-respected teacher and veteran improviser at the Annoyance Theater here in Chicago. He was in the original cast of Coed Prison Sluts way back in the 1980s. He was in the Second City Touring Company. He was in this incredible group called Carta Giants, which came out of the University of Chicago. People like John Hildreth and Greg Kotis were in that group. And Bang Bang, which had people like Tracy Letts, the Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright, and Michael Shannon, who's been nominated for Academy Awards. He returned to Chicago several years ago after living in Los Angeles and Phoenix for 18 years. Bob, who's also an attorney, we talked to him about how improv helped him win a murder case when he was younger, getting somebody off murder. Also, how agreement starts before we even get on stage, and how he looks at bad shows versus good shows. You are going to love this episode. Bob is so thoughtful about improvisation. He gives you a lot of philosophy here, so you're really going to need to absorb it. It's really, really chock full of very helpful stuff, and I just want to thank Bob for doing this. I've known Bob since the 80s. At the Annoyance Theater, I was actually in Coed Prison Sluts. I didn't originate it. I was an understudy, and I played Hamster Man. I don't mean to be name-dropping or something like that, but I was Hamster Man. I wasn't the original Hamster Man. I was the second. And I believe Matt Walsh from Veep, I'm going to name-drop what the hell, was the third Hamster Man, and he was a much better Hamster Man. That was a part that I really wasn't right for, to be honest with you, but it was fun doing the show. Before we get to the episode with Bob, I just want to say it's great to be back. I feel like, I miss talking to you guys and letting you know what's going on in my life. And I just want to tell you that Betsy Jane Corrane, that's her name. That's the song we sing. Betsy Jane, Betsy Jane, Betsy Jane Corrane. That's your name, Betsy Jane Corrane. We kind of do a little musical improv, and then we'll add another verse like, Betsy Jane Corrane, Betsy Jane Corrane, your dad's insane, and your mom's got a big brain. So we're kind of indoctrinating into improv, and I figure we'll start her with musical improv first. But she is crawling, and she just got, this morning, we just found out that she has she had two teeth on the bottom, and now she has a tooth on the top. So we're really, really excited. And I also just want to say something about that, because I'm really enjoying it, and this kind of ties into it. I bought another book. You know that I'm into the self-help books. I love the self-help books. Apparently, the self-help books aren't working because I asked my wife. I picked up another one about happiness. This one's called How to Be Alive, A Guide to the Kind of Happiness That Helps the World. And I said to my wife, I said, I'm buying these happiness books. Have you seen a difference? And she said, no, I really don't see a difference. So apparently they're not working. But she did say this, you seem very happy around Betsy. So I'm making progress, people. You can't go from Eeyore to Piglet to Pooh in one day. It's a lifetime. Was that not the most spiritual and most wise thing I've said on this podcast in the last 5 years? I think it is. If you really want to hear wisdom, you got to listen to this episode. Bob Fisher gives you so much. He's such a great teacher, and he's such a great improviser. And he's a guy that admits that, he didn't think he's funny. He doesn't consider himself a comedian. And he's a great, great improviser and great teacher. You are going to learn and get so much out of this episode. So here it is. It's great to be back. The Bob Fisher episode. Enjoy.
Jimmy's a nerd. He's a nerd. Oh, yeah. Jimmy's a nerd. He's a nerd.
Hello, Bob.
Hey, Jimmy.
Bob Fisher, thank you so much for being our guest on Improv Nerd.
Oh, thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Now, you grew up in Des Plaines, Illinois. It's a suburb outside of Chicago.
Yes, it is.
You were seventh of nine children. How did you get attention in your family?
When you're at the tail end of a big family like that, only entertaining is left, right? The good kids and the bad kids and everything else, it's already taken. So you just have to be a goof.
So when you say a goof, what kind of stuff did you do to get your parents and your siblings' attention?
Oh, you know, I think like anybody, there's old family videos of the kids running around pretending to be zombies or, you know, anything like that. Just the id kind of thing.
And did you have other siblings that you would have act out with you and stuff like that? Or were you just...
Kind of. You know, my sister Laura is an actress,
yes,
right? Laura Fisher.
Yeah. And, a great actress.
Yeah, yeah. Really. And in fact, somewhere in here we'll talk about that. I got to perform with her. And but as kids, right? So she ended up being the one who actually went and got a theater training and a theater degree.
Was she older than you?
No, she's the kid. She's the eighth.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then you grew up playing sports.
I did.
And you didn't have any kind of theater background in high school or college, right?
That's right.
And then you go to the University of Chicago and you study political science. How did you end up in improv?
Well, really, it's people that you know. Because I was in Hyde Park, because I lived in Chicago, I had seen Second City, and there wasn't much else back then, right? But in Hyde Park, there was a guy named Steve Schroer, and he was a teacher at the university. In the theater, there wasn't a theater department, but he was a guy doing some theater, and he knew a lot about improvisation. He put up classes, and he created groups, and he created a group that was performing at Jimmy's Woodlawn Tap. I happen to know a guy whose brother was in that group, Peter Lordy, whose brother Phil Lordy was in this group called Avant Garfield, and John Hildreth was in that group, Scott Herms was in that group, Mark Holman was in that group, on and on. That was the first time that I saw improvisation where I thought there was a code, like a secret code that they were sharing, like a card trick, you know? And I had to figure out what that was. I started going to that show because a guy said, want to go see my brother, and I started going every week. Every week I was going to that show at Jimmy's Woodlawn Tap to try to figure out how they were making it happen. And then somewhere in there, months in there, they announced that there was going to be a one-day improv workshop at the U of C with this guy, Del Close. And that was my first improv workshop. It was a one-day workshop with Del Close.
So how do you get into the group then from there?
Well, again, just like an unbelievable number of really lucky breaks. Because after I did that one-day workshop with Del Close, the very next, whatever, year... Bernie Sollins, whose brother Marshall Sollins was a professor at the U of C, was coaxed down to teach a class at the U of C.
And Bernie Sollins was, of course, one of the founders of Second City.
Yeah, director, producer, and at that point, maybe emeritus or close to it. Mm-hmm. I think he was still directing the main stage. He came down, he taught a class. It led to a show, a sketch comedy show, in a group called Off Campus, which still exists to this day, so 30 years later. And in auditions for that class was when I met Greg Kotas, who later on joined Avant Garfield and then Cardiff Giant at the same time I did. So we joined that group with John Hildreth and Mark Holman and Scott Herms and on and on.
What were you like when you first started out?
Oh, man. Oh, my goodness. I talk about this because... when I started improvising, I was 100% high status, what you call high status, right? I was always some kind of powerful character, always super smart, always had a solution for any problem that arose in the scene, even if it took like superhero powers, right? And the guy in the group that ended up intriguing me as I became more and more bored with myself was Mark Holman. Mark Holman played kind of quiet characters, guys who suffered more than they solved their problems. He was hilarious, right? The way he couldn't get through his moments was so endearing and so funny. And it was the first time I thought, okay, I'm tired of playing the powerful characters. I want to play people who are affected more than they affect.
Now, so you're basically learning as you go along, right?
Yeah.
What did you learn from you from the other members of the group? Because it was like a powerhouse group.
Oh man, it was crazy. John Hildreth, whom you know, I think is a genius.
Great, yes.
And other people in the group who came before me would maybe, you know, look at this differently, and I would have to defer to them. But for me, he set the tone of that group.
Who did?
John.
John, in what way?
You know, he can play characters that are so grounded and so big at the same time, right?
And, yeah, and he can also find a point of view so quickly.
Oh, for sure. And not only, you know, anybody can improvise a funny line or a funny character, but not many improvisers can kind of play out a comedy routine in the middle of a scene, right? Like A to B to C, like just find the moments that stack up to an hilarious routine. And he does that effortlessly. And I think because of how committedly he could play a large character, that group had kind of a vaudeville feeling. And that, I think, influenced the style of our plays that we did later. And that definitely has influenced my work. I always look for people to play grounded, but then once they're believing what they are doing, I would rather them be bigger than smaller.
But what's interesting is there's kind of an abstract, an absurd quality to your work sometimes, besides the grounded. But also you were an attorney, so how do you balance that? Because when you think of an attorney, you think of a rule follower, got to be right, and then you've got this kind of more absurd, bigger, grounded, but you know, performer.
Oh, sure, and you know, I suppose there's a conflict there. Ultimately, I think they complement each other, and any good attorney is going to be both creative because they got to think outside the norms. Otherwise, they'd just be telling somebody, "Well, we all know how this case turns out, right? Because it's been done before." A good attorney is going to say, "I want to look at this in a fresh way, a different way, and maybe I can get you a better outcome than somebody who doesn't think more creatively." I did have one. I don't know. Do you have time for a story?
Yes, I do. All right. We love stories.
I'm
going to
tell you
podcast.
I'll tell you one story about how improvisation helped with being an attorney. So I was working for an attorney who did criminal defense. He handed a case off to me of a young guy who was accused of attempted murder, like a drive-by shooting. He handed it off to me because there was like $3,000 available in the case. Wasn't enough money to interest my boss. And it was just going to be a guilty plea, right? You just take a kid down, first time offender. And in an afternoon, you're going to make $3,000, right? Well, he said he didn't do it. He insisted that he didn't do it. And so I said, well, I'm not going to plead you guilty. And about a year and a half later, literally working for a year and a half on this case for $3,000, I was in trial. My first trial ever. And it's an attempt to murder trial where if this doesn't go well, this young man's going to go away to prison for forever. It was nerve-wracking, and it was the real deal. Long, long days, exhausting, mentally draining. Anyway, we get to closing argument.
This is a jury trial.
It was a jury trial. That's exactly right. Right? Four different, what they called at that time, Class X felonies in Illinois. And if I lose any of them, he's going to prison for a long time. And the facts weren't in his favor at all.
How old are you at this time?
Late 20s, I think, okay. Right? Maybe early 30s. So this room is as big as a black box theater. The area between where the jury is and the judge and the counsel tables, it's a big square down at 26th and California, which is a gigantic old courthouse. And so the prosecution lays out its case, and there were some weaknesses in their case, but there were some real strengths to their case too. And I had just asked all the witnesses way too many questions, a ton of questions to find inconsistencies. And one of the things that had happened was one of the witnesses had said, that describing the drive-by shooting, had said, well, the car came down the street, and it was kind of rolling along like 10 miles an hour, and then they stopped, and they talked to the people next to the car, and then they shot them, and then they drove away. And I had said, and okay, so they drove away. How fast did they drive away? And the witness said, well, about 10 miles an hour. And so in closing argument, I'm laying out all these facts, and I'm talking to the jury, and I said, you know, 10 miles an hour. That's kind of a funny way to do a drive-by shooting, drive away at 10 miles an hour. And I looked at them and I said, maybe they were looking for parking. And the jury cracked up. And I knew, and everybody knew at that moment, it's over. We're going to win. And we did.
Because you got the laugh?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, once a jury is laughing at the prosecution's case, you're in good shape. And so that was 40 minutes where I didn't have a script. I had like 15 bullet points. And it was just me in front of a jury, high stakes, right? And my client is sitting right next to me. He's sitting, I'm standing, and I'm working a room the size of a black box theater for 40 minutes, you know, keeping their attention and making points. And that was 80% improv.
What does the guy say to you when he gets off?
It's crazy because for somebody in that position, a young man accused of a terrible crime, you know, I'm just some white guy,
right.
Who's costing his family money, who he shouldn't have to know in a way, right? They got done. His mom was there. His mom was lovely and very, of course, very emotional. She had her Bible with her. We got done with the case, and they drove me to the L, which was like four blocks away.
Right.
Because they were going to a family party.
Right.
I wasn't invited to the family party.
Right.
I was dropped off at the L, and I'm sitting there, you know, on the L. I just want a trial. And I'm taking the L. I didn't have a car. And I was living in Rogers Park, so it was like a long ride by myself with no one to tell. I want a trial.
Right. Well, just so people, most attorneys would get in a Lexus and
drive to the
suburbs.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, that's right. I wasn't that guy.
That's a great story. Now, also, at this time, you are with a group called Bang Bang.
Yeah, that came up too.
And what I find interesting, I mean, the people that were in it, Tracy Letts,
yes.
Michael Shannon, Kate Walsh from Grey's Anatomy, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Right.
These are people, straight theater people, right?
Yes.
And then we've got the improv-trained people. So how was improvising with these more... actors and someone like you who was a trained improviser.
It was great, and it was a real education. You know, a guy named Paul Dillon, who
wrote Hellcab.
No, he was the star. Will Kern wrote Hellcab, and Paul Dillon was the original cab driver on Hellcab for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And Paul Dillon, I knew because Paul Dillon played Killer Joe in the Tracy Letts play Killer Joe that Shauna Franks, my wife, was also in. And so I met all of them basically through the cast of Killer Joe. And Paul Dillon had gone to classes at Second City. So his level five, if that's what it was at the time, his level five grad class had put up a show at No Exit in Rogers Park.
Which was this little beatnik, old hippies ran coffee shop.
Yes, with basically a 4-square-foot triangle stage in the corner, right? And they were doing a show, just bits, and he joined it. And then he said, can I bring a friend along? And he brought Tracy Letts. And he said, can I bring another friend? And he brought Michael Shannon. He brought Reggie Hayes. He brought all kinds of really good people. I'm forgetting good people. And then at some point they said, we need one experienced improviser. Like, you know, more experienced. And that's how I got to come in.
What was their style?
Zero structure. Bits, just jokes. Really offensive humor. Silly. And then suddenly... there would be Michael Shannon on stage with Tracy Letts or with me or with somebody doing amazing characters, doing really deep committed characters, sometimes still in the service of comedy and sometimes not.
Were you what role did you have? Were you the guy saying, okay, we got to agree here, or were you just like, okay, let's just do what you guys do?
I didn't really have a role.
Mm-hmm.
I was just the guy. I was happy to be there. We got to do shows at, I hope I don't get this wrong, the Remains Theater, if that's the right one, in Clybourne, on Clybourne.
Yeah, it's no longer, but yes.
First it had been Bernie's Commedia Theater, that failed, and then it became the Remains space, and then they went out of business. And during the time that the cast was doing Killer Joe, they would leave that production, that show, at the Noise Arts Center, right?
Right, it was the Next Theater.
Yeah, the Next Noise Lab, yeah. Right. And then everyone would cruise down to the Remains to do a show really late night and like 2 hours. That was a gigantic theater, and maybe there were 30 people, I don't know how many, maybe less. And we would just improvise openly, ridiculously for, it would seem like hours.
Do you remember anything you, working, fond memories with Michael Shannon or Tracy Letts?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And they're both super talented, obviously.
Very intense.
Obvious. Yes. There are scenes that I remember very well that crack me up still, right?
Can you tell us about one?
All right.
Okay.
I was doing a scene. Okay, so you were describing the place, the hipster. What did you say, hippies who ran?
It was two old hippies.
It was like, great. Yeah. feeling of that place, right? Mm-hmm. But definitely, right? An old coffee shop, and there were knickknacks and odd paintings and things. And one of the things that was right behind the stage were two of these ceramic beer steins with faces on them. And I started a scene as a very silly character who was a fan of opera and started out grabbing those ceramic mugs and saying, I love my opera audience member figurines. And I'm talking about the figurines and I'm saying some silly things, and Tracy Letts starts performing an opera in front of me. Now he's wearing this red turtleneck. He pulls it up over his head and he starts singing through it. Where is my head? I've lost my head. That's the opera. And now I'm playing the two decanters or whatever they are as puppets. So they're talking over Tracy. They're criticizing the play, the opera. They're being nasty and petty, right? I'm doing this whole bit. And at some point, while I'm doing the bit, I turn away because I'm just playing with them. And Tracy leaves. Tracy leaves completely.
Like out, leaves the cafe?
He's performing right in front of me. He just, yeah, I don't know. He probably just sat down. But he was gone from the scene, right? And I turn back. I'd been completely silly. He's gone, and the moment changes to a moment where I'm alone, and the whole opera had been my fantasy, and I'm just at home alone, remembering someone who I'd lost, and a very silly, really silly scene. All of a sudden, I had this 20-second coda of just sadness. And that was the kind of thing that was possible there.
Well, it's interesting because you tell me this, you're getting sad now.
Oh, yeah. I mean, as I remember, this is exactly how I encountered it. You know, I turned back, the guy's gone. And as you know, as an improviser, you're thinking, what's possible here, right? And anything's possible. So for me, the possibility was none of this was real. And this was all a fantasy. And that's how I'm existing right now. And it was really sad.
You know, in the pre-interview, I asked you a question about how you describe improv in three words or something like that.
Yes.
And you said...
I said, improvisation is nothing.
Can you explain that?
Which part? The nothing?
Yes.
Yes. Yeah, this is what I try to stress now. You know, we were talking about how, you know, the things that have always intrigued me and sometimes frustrated me or beguiled me about improvisation is the public tends to celebrate people who are improvisers for things that aren't improvisation, right? They're on sketch shows or they're in movies or something, right? And as improvisers even, we often look to people who are the funniest or the wittiest or the quick-wittedest. Or who have amazing structural minds, like wrapping up a show on the last line is the first line, or everything gets wrapped up in a bow. Amazing skills, right? And sometimes those are the things that we equate with improvisation. And I think sometimes that is a value system that excludes people and that limits the possibilities of what improvisation can be. And I see people in classes that I teach, the example that I give over and over, like every class I teach, is two people walk out on stage, right to the middle. They stand at a distance of an arm's length plus a few inches, because that's the distance that you stand when you want to be safe and you want nothing to happen. And then that's what happens. Two people stand at about that distance. They talk. They say funny things. They get tagged out by two people who stand roughly in the same two spots. They talk with a different accent, or they create different who, what, where with their words, right? And it gets boring pretty quickly. So I stress to people both within the choices they make in a scene, but also in their futures as improvisers, that the beauty of improvisation is not that it's comedy, that it's entertainment, that it's anything. The beauty of it is that I show up with you, we could have a script, we could have props, we could have sets, we could have a real detailed plan. But instead what we say is, let's go and have nothing, right? Let's have nothing together. And let's go out in front of an audience with nothing. And let's encounter the unknown together and discover it and have fun discovering it.
what still, why do you still like to improv? And you talked about, again, in the pre-interview about this agreement that we have.
Yeah.
Can you explain it?
Yeah, for sure. I mean,
and we're not just talking about the yes and that we do on stage. You're saying agreement actually happens before we get on stage.
Oh, yes. And in fact, you know, one of the things improvisers talk about is going meta, meaning abandoning the conceit that your characters inside of your show, inside of scenes inside your show. But when you think about it, there's probably 20 agreements at least that you make in advance of a quote-unquote improvised show.
Give me an example of a couple.
What time you're going to be there, right? We're going to meet at the theater. I mean, the most meta thing would be to just start improvising wherever you are and expect that you'll meet another improviser, right?
Right.
That doesn't happen. That doesn't make sense. So we make a lot of agreements, and we make agreements about certain things that we will do, like use our words, we'll speak in English, you know, we're going to come with clothes on, there will be no fist fighting, you know, and then certain ones that we're still learning that are the right things to do and not the right things to do to maintain a positive experience for all the improvisers and the audience, right? And I think we're all still learning and changing. But all these agreements... And again, that basic one is we've agreed to maybe completely fail because it'd be safer to have a script. And we choose not to. And I think it's because that discovery is itself a wonderful and valuable thing. So when I encounter people who think, oh, I've learned the Herald and I could do it in my sleep. It's just, you know, I know the bits and I know the... I feel like they're missing it. They're missing the point and the jadedness of some improvisers when they feel like they've mastered the form in 18 months. I just figure, okay, you're done in 3 years, aren't you? If you don't get Hollywood or something.
And what is your philosophy on a bad show versus a good show?
Well, for me, the worst show is the one where after the show, you don't remember that you made that agreement before the show. That you didn't make, you forget that you made that agreement that maybe we're going to be horrible. You know, I don't want to be in a show, either myself or with the people I'm performing with, where we go to the four winds separately, or we go to the corner, or like I'm angry at myself or I'm angry at you. You know, there's room for that. It happens. And some people are sometimes cross a line and we have to work it out, right? Like people do. But mainly we came into it saying this might be horrible. And the price is that it might be horrible is what we pay for the chance to be amazing spontaneously.
You've been doing this for a long, long time. What do you think, and this is probably not a fair question, but in terms of failure rate, what you would say was a bad show, what percentage do you think that is?
100.
100%?
No, I have no idea.
But I mean, I guess my question is like, you're still, because I know for me it's true, I'm still doing bad shows.
Oh, yeah,
I'm
yeah.
still doing terrible shows, and I've been doing this for 25 years.
About once a year, and it depends. About once a year, I'll do a show where I say, I'm done, that's it. Never again. Mm-hmm. And it's never because I aced it.
Right, but that's the really bad show. There's probably, for me, maybe another, let's say if I do 30 shows a year, I'd say 10 are probably pretty bad, and then there's two terrible ones, and, you know, 10 excellent ones, and 10, you know, pretty good ones.
Well, I'd like to believe that any bad show is a chance to learn something about yourself, if not about your craft, right? So I just did a show last week at The Annoyance. They have a great show that involves combining senior performers with student performers. It's called Fishbowl. It's on Thursdays. It's really fun. And they do a very smart thing, which is they control the number of senior performers who sign up, and then they control how many of those senior performers can be on stage at one time. They want it to be a mix that if it's going to lean in any direction, it's going to lead towards the students. I think it's great. Well, I wasn't signed up. They had a whole list of people. Those people were like, come on, join in. Just be here. We're here. We want you to join in. I reluctantly said yes. And I think I was probably okay. If I saw a video of the show, I'd say, oh, yeah, I was okay. But I felt bad. And every choice that I made, I felt bad. I went through a filter of feeling bad, at least. And when I left, that's what I considered. How badly did I screw this up, right? And what I learned was, you know, if I decide I shouldn't be here, then I shouldn't be here, and nothing in the show is going to change my mind, right? I mean, you can say, I'm in a funk, let me do a good physical warm-up or connect with my... That's different. I think if you believe that you shouldn't be in a situation, then you shouldn't be in it. And that was just a moment, and nobody got hurt. But I like the idea that I'm going to come away from a show and say, oh yeah, you know, I've learned something again. We were talking as a younger improviser, right? You move fast. You want to travel far in your show and do a lot of speedy things and have lots of, well, I can't do topical references anymore, right? Hardly. But now I'm older. I move more slowly. I love doing grounded, organic scenes. I love to just step out and discover what I see in my partner's eyes. I teach people now that have difficulty making eye contact and maintaining it because maybe they come from stand-up comedy or they're just not used to that in life and they don't know the value of it. Then they get on stage and they make eye contact and they each maybe have an emotional state and all of a sudden the audience, even the audience of other students, they laugh. They laugh not because it's so funny, but they laugh at the recognition of that human moment. They know it, right? They already know or they have an idea of what might be going on. I love that stuff now. You know, I love going into a show and hopefully having some kind of emotionally cathartic moment. And that has real value for me.
Also, you came back from Chicago. You were in Los Angeles and yes. Phoenix for 18 years.
Yeah, about 9 each.
So you come back about three or four years ago.
Yeah.
And you were really established here in Chicago with Carta Giant. You were at Second City Touring Company, The Annoyance, Bang Bang. Now you come back. What has it been like to come back and see the changes here?
It's crazy and amazing, right? I love The Annoyance. I always have.
What do you love about? What was it that you loved about The Annoyance?
Oh, just everything. I mean, I don't know where to start, to be honest. I talk about how lucky I was. I had that one day workshop with Del Close. Then I get a class with Bernie Silent. He doesn't teach anywhere, right? He comes down and teaches a sketch comedy show. Then Greg Kotis and I decide to go to Second City and take classes, and our level one teacher is Mick Napier. That's just like, you know, you're winning the lottery without buying a ticket.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I felt, right? The people at The Annoyance were great. Sometimes people think of The Annoyance as liking filthy humor, and in a way that's true. But in a way what it is it's about how free you can be, right? If you're not going to be limited in the kind of work that you can do, in the kind of choices you can make, there's a sort of a freedom that goes with that. And it really felt like a place that people could express themselves as honestly or as wildly as they wanted to. And the weird thing, we've talked a little bit about how, you know, we're in a time of change and a time of progress, and I think it's important, and I think it's going to lead to real progress.
You're talking about right now. What's going on in the improv community?
Yeah, for sure. And here we are, two old white guys talking right. about it. That's garbage, right? I'm sorry, everybody.
Right.
But I do. I believe that it's leading to good things. I think it will lead to good things, and I think there are going to be difficult, painful moments along the way. And you were talking about, like, how do I tell people, oh, yeah, I was in co-ed Prison Sluts, and I'm really proud of that show. It's filthy, right? It's vile intentionally. And I am proud of it.
For people who don't know, I mean, there's a pedophile in there. You were a murderer, right?
I played...
Henry
killed people and ate them.
Right.
And it was really, really funny until Jeffrey Dahmer came along.
Right.
And then for a certain number of years, it wasn't very funny. But he had the same song, and it was a pretty good song.
Right.
So, you know, the thing about that is, you know, when people want to judge the person based on the content of their comedy, I understand. You don't want to make people hurt, right? I don't want to make other performers hurt, especially in some lazy comic way for no artistic even goal, much less gain. I don't want to do that. Right? But I'll tell you that the cast of Coed, right, this filthy, vile show, those people are so kind and so sweet, and I love them all. And they're very good people who all made a really vile show. And so I guess I have that in my back pocket when I hear people talking about wanting to cut someone out of performing community because they made certain online choices or performance choices or joke choices.
We got to take a quick break here, and then we'll be right back after this. You know, the other thing that I find interesting is you had a second, you were Second City trained.
Yes.
And then, you know, Carter Giant, and then Bang Bang. And you're teaching at The Annoyance. And The Annoyance has this very, you know, specific way to do it, which is you go out, you take care of yourself, you don't take care of your partner. How does your philosophy in improv and really mixed philosophy or The Annoyance style work together when you teach your class?
Well, I'll tell you this. One of the things that I love about The Annoyance, and I think is true in all improvisation, I had a very funny encounter with Miles Struth. You know Miles?
Sure. From the Improv Olympic, right? And now he's got a theater in L.A., The Pack.
The Pack, right. Theater. So he has, when I was living in Phoenix, he would visit Phoenix and he would perform. We were standing next to each other. We really don't know each other very well. And at that time, we had never, ever performed together. Later, he came down and we did a one-off, which was great. But we were standing together, and somebody came up who thought that she really understood everything in a nutshell. And she looked at us and said, "So, IO, take care of your seat partner. Annoyance, take care of yourself, right?" And without checking in, we were both like, "What? What are you talking about? No, no, that's not right." And this went on for 5 minutes where we just didn't even acknowledge the possibility that that was true. And that cracked me up. It also matches what I believe. I think ultimately, if you're going to say, "I'm going to take care of my scene partner," but your scene partner has nothing and you bring nothing, what are you taking care of, right? If I don't bring something, what's my scene partner taking care of? Now, I love organic improvisation where maybe all I bring is an emotion and you see it in me, and then you start making choices that are at least consistent with what you feel and what we feel. And the more we work together, the more we're going to be like, yeah, we got it right, sort of, right? Or we ended up in the same ballpark based on just who we felt we might be. And Pesquese talks a lot about that, about the possibility that you can look into your scene partner's eyes and kind of get a sense of who they are, who they think they are, right? Without kind of doing who, what, where announcements. So for me, what I love about The Annoyance, I know I went long on your question, but they believe that the students are going to take what they believe in, what works for them, and drop the rest, right? So Annoyance believes you take care of yourself because they want you to be able to make very full choices.
So come out and you have a very strong character choice.
Right, and you shouldn't feel like you can't do that because you're with somebody else. They want to prove to you that you can make the fullest commitment, and so can your scene partner, and you're going to be fine. And I believe that too. But I see a lot of scenes where people aren't committed, and then they also don't connect. And that's just, to me, death on stage.
And how do you commit and connect? Let's take the commit part. What's the easiest way to come out and commit?
What I do for me, what works for me, and that's what all I tell my students is what works for me and what I've seen work for other people. Again, it's for them to choose. I like starting with an emotion. You know, I didn't ever get to study with Martin DeMott, but because of his friendship with Mick, I got to meet him and talk to him about improvisation. And one of the things he talked about was fake it till you make it. And I believe that was his improvisation statement. I only learned later that it's an AA thing, which is fine too, which is great. But the idea for me that you go out with an emotion and you don't know why you have it.
So if you were going to start a scene right now with an emotion, how would you start it?
I would, a lot of times I like a physical activity, and I've learned for myself, the bigger it is, the more it might take me away from developing a character, maintaining a character. So a lot of times now, I will have an activity that's as small as like something, I'm holding something that would barely take up my hand, right? And then maybe I'm picking things out of it with my other fingers.
So you'll start with something physical, okay.
I'll have something physical and have a feeling about maybe about it, but maybe about me or my world. The thing is if I have an emotion already, and then I allow myself to connect that emotion to whatever my scene partner brings me, now we have a relationship. And for the audience, we make that first step of saying, we've asked you to believe that we're in a world together. Now we're going to give you proof, right? When two improvisers don't even look at each other at the top of a scene, we lose that first moment of saying, yeah, we're really here together. So start suspending your disbelief. Start applying your life experience to be intrigued by what you see between two people. So what I do is I seek eye contact. I seek the moment. I'm okay before that. I make sure I'm okay before that. That's the annoyance part, right? But for me, these days, an emotion, and I grab something out of the air, and it's a stick. Now I'm sad, and I'm holding a stick. I'm figuring out why. I'm already ready to look at my scene partner. He's going to see my sadness, and maybe he says, your balloon is...
your balloon's deflated.
Yeah, deflating, and I'm like, yeah, guess my birthday's over.
Yeah,
it is.
Yeah, Stan.
Right? And now, if he's smiling through that, maybe he's a sadist. And if he hangs on to his deal, like he starts smiling at me, if he looks at me, like a lot of improvisers would, and say, oh, right, he's smiling, but then he sees I'm sad, he goes, oh, I'm sorry. Well, he's given up a gift, right? That first second of a scene where everything you need is there, all you got to do is follow it.
And really, what you just adjusted with the typical improv, kind of a rookie move would be, you're sad, and then I'm going to apologize for it. And you're saying, no, look, if you come in there and you don't have to figure out why you're a sadist or why you're mean to this guy whose birthday is over and his balloon is lost all its air, hold on to that and heighten that.
Yeah. In fact, you don't ever have to decide that you're a sadist. You just have to keep being happy. The right. audience will see that you're a sadist, or mm-hmm. they'll see that you're very, very sweet. Maybe they think you're a child, mm-hmm. right? Maybe they think you're some kind of angelic figure. That's up to them, right? They do the work. Sometimes I tell performers, you just be your dot. You know,
be your what?
Be a dot. You just be your dot, and the audience will see Sunday in the Park,
mm-hmm.
right? Meaning, you're in a group scene, you're over in the corner, nobody's even acknowledging you, you might be a tree, or you might be a coat rack, and nobody in your cast comes over to you, and you think, this blows. But it doesn't, right? The audience sees a bigger stage picture because you're in it. I encourage people to do shows without so much reliance on a back wall. I like people who will play a rock, or a desk, or a tree, you know, because then they're in the show more, too, right? The back wall is where we go to feed our fears and our self-judgment. And I like people to get off that wall as much as they can.
So the connecting part, because you talked about two parts on that, one is commitment, the other is connection. Connecting is simple for is you just when you come out doing a scene, you're just going to make eye contact with your partner?
I think sometimes... experience helps, right? I talk to students when they deal with somebody who I describe as like somebody could be a brick wall in a scene, right?
Meaning they're not giving anything.
Right.
To
they're not. You're
they're
giving
a blank
them
a, slate. Yeah.
Yeah. You're doing emotions and they're doing ideas, right? And maybe they're just doing transaction. And I'm looking for connection. Well, on stage and I think in life, what happens in those moments is the person with the emotions goes higher. They don't fade away or give up. They go further, right? Now you're doing all the... one character's doing all the emotional work.
Right.
And it's still a very powerful scene. Maybe that character who's like a brick wall shows a crack, right? Like a high-status character, I always tell people, only you can invent your kryptonite, right? Only you can show your vulnerability in a scene where you're playing high-status, you're playing unable to be affected. Then you give your scene partner that gift. They offer you something and you are affected. Now they can really drill into that gift that you gave them, right? So for me, I look at somebody on stage and I think my experience tells me, how am I connecting with this other performer? Are we both, you know, building separately and the audience sees a causal relationship? We're good. Are we going to both focus on either a physical object or a concept that we're sharing? We're good, right? Are we in some kind of hostility? Are we in an argument that I'm going to want to lose pretty quickly? I'm going to want to show my pain pretty quickly, right? I'm good with that, you know? So I think that's what happens is you figure out what's your relationship with both the character and the performer.
Let's talk about this argument and wanting to lose it pretty quickly, because I think... And I always struggle with arguments still. tell me about why. What's the advantage of losing an argument? Because I think what happens is people get into an argument, and I think just our natural instinct takes over, and we want to win the argument.
Yeah,
but what's the advantage
sure.
of a character losing the argument?
Okay, I think there's like multiple parts to this discussion.
Okay.
How much time do we have? Are you looking at the clock?
I'm not looking at the clock.
Oh, good.
I stopped looking at the clock a long time ago.
Good. First off, and I'll tell you this. First, I'm really informed. I was lucky enough to do a workshop with Dave Pesquese like 2 years ago.
How was that? Like, here you are. You're certainly, you know, like, you're a peer of his.
I'm older than him, I think.
You're older than him.
Yeah.
And here you are. You come back, and you're taking a workshop.
I love going to workshops. Every once in a while, I encounter a teacher who's not comfortable with me being in their workshop. But mostly, they're okay, and I learn things, right? And I think I contribute, and I, again, right? How are you going to learn without getting out of your comfort zone? And I don't know what that is until I get with another improviser who thinks about it passionately and is going to say different things to me than I say to myself. And he really did. It was great. And in some ways, I think I succeeded. In some ways, he pointed out ways I didn't, and I failed. And he brought up new ways to think about things. And one of them that I steal just rampantly is this notion. I'm going to paraphrase it and not say it well, but he said, you know, you're going to start a scene where your character doesn't have the sandwich that he ordered, and the scene is about I don't have what I want, and I'm unhappy, and where you're going to play your characters in a world where they have what they want, where you get to know them in the world that they would design if they could, right? And I think that's kind of cool because you spend less time talking about transactions, talking about problems, making your scene about problems. It's normative in that, right? It probably leans towards lighter characters, lighter scenes. The more often people are in a happy place, right? That's not necessarily true. And you've seen their shows. I would be completely wrong to say, oh yeah, they do. They just do happy things. But I like that idea. I like the idea that, like, if you find that you're starting scenes with problems, you're probably going to lose opportunities to just be your character, right? Improvisers, young improvisers, they look for importance, and so the first line is, this isn't working out. I think you need to move out. I think I'm going to have to fire you, right? We haven't even met them. We don't even know their status, and they're already changing the status. And I get it. You want to do a scene of moment, of importance. But why not just find the importance in the emotions between your everyday existence?
And how would that look?
I think that looks like having emotions, being open to them, and then finding out that this character, we just catch them in this snapshot moment where the first thing that's said is really tied to their emotional life. I'm often at an emotional state that's higher than average because I don't want to be waiting for it. I don't want to wait for my scene to justify me having an emotion, because I think that's what the audience came to see, is people being in moments of consequence, right? We live in lives where we avoid consequence, we avoid contact, we got to avoid conflict. We don't even want eye contact. So much of our lives is avoidance, right? And then I want to go to a show. I don't want to see avoidance. I don't want to see no stakes.
So if excitement was the emotion you decided to do, what kind of line would you probably start with?
I don't think excitement is an emotion.
Okay.
Sorry.
So I don't want my students to hear this. What do you qualify as an emotion?
I start with four. And
okay.
Certainly.
The happy, mad, sad, glad, afraid?
Yep. Right? How many just do? And I say you can do passion, right? Right, attraction. You can do repulsion because they're motivating, right? They motivate your movements on stage, your choices.
So are you saying you only play four emotions on stage, or six emotions? I think we just with repulsion and passion.
Yeah, and because I say that as a teacher, I'll tell you this as a performer, and I think a lot of performers would say this. When I get on stage, I forget everything I teach, everything I believe. I just get up there and go. And hopefully what I've worked into my bones, like a golfer, we talk about muscle memory, I can just do a show. And afterwards people are like, you know, last week you told us all these things, and then you just sat in a chair and told jokes. And I said, yeah, that's that show tonight. I sat in a chair and I told jokes. I'm sorry. Was it funny? Oh, yeah, I had a good time. Yeah, me too. Right? Sometimes you're in a show where you're just like, I don't know. I don't know why I never spoke. I don't know why, I was just the supportive character, never spoke. I didn't come to the theater to do that, but it ended up being my rhythm.
So if passion was your emotion, and you don't want to get into a conflict, right?
Oh, so
you don't
argument.
Want to start with a,
right.
And you want to be in this reality where everything is...
Nobody cares about the sandwich, right? Nobody cares about who caused the accident, who lost the keys, why...
Why didn't the dishes, weren't the dishes
right.
washed?
Why is this marriage ending? Nobody right. really cares. Right. They care about the people, mm-hmm. right? And they care about the emotions. And the argument itself tends to be left brain, tends to be only anger, tends to be intellectual arguments, not explosive displays. So I think if you're going to argue, I want to know how you argue. And you better be ridiculous in how you argue, right? Over the top can be fun, right? And that can be tons of anger directed at each other. A lot of times I tell people, if you're going to have a lot of anger, maybe direct it outside your scene, right? A shared focus. Those fucking Cubs, right? Is this a no cursing show?
Yeah, you can curse.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
I'm really fucking sorry. right? But if we're going to be angry, then I want to be over the top.
Mm-hmm.
But you asked about, and other people say this, I didn't create this, and I'm not going to say it as well as they do. The idea of losing an argument means, right, behind anger, behind fear, it's always something positive, right? You want something good. You don't have the thing you want. That's what you want to expose, right? The vulnerability and the positive dream of your character. And you can't do that if you try to win the argument. And if you both try to win the argument, that's how your scene's going to end. Right? Because two smart improvisers can never decide, yes, you're right. And who cares if we did, right? So better to just get to the point of like, I'm hurt. I miss you. I want this to work out so badly, right? And now you're seeking connection instead of fighting for something that nobody in the audience really cares about. You never leave the show and go like, man, he really got the mayonnaise he wanted on that sandwich, right? Good thing.
So you're almost saying when you get in an argument, it's something in your back pocket. You can pull out, be vulnerable, you know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
This isn't about the mayonnaise. It's about you didn't show up to my birthday last night.
Right, right.
You're my best friend.
Right. And if you're going to do that, you have two choices to do that. It's your next argument in heightening the anger and the intellectual argument, or it's a reveal. And the reveal can be devastating. Who's it going to be devastating to? You know, again, like, if I'm a high-status character, my scene partner could try to break me, but really, I have to give it to them. In the same way, if I'm going to lose an argument, I can't make my scene partner lose. Only I can choose it, right? So that's what I control. So if I'm going to give it up, I can give it up with vulnerability. I can give it up as a reveal to another side of myself. Now the scene's that much richer.
And I could be revealing and say, you didn't show up to my birthday party. I was really hurt. And you could turn around and be vulnerable, or you could turn around and shove it back in my face.
Yeah. And now, right, we go to one of those, we're not butting heads. Now you're vulnerable and I'm going to get mean. And now the audience is like, wow, I thought that guy was okay. But turns out he's an asshole, right? And you don't have to say it. You don't have to prove it intellectually. You just be it.
You know, with my students, sometimes playing the asshole is so hard, you know? And I know it for even me sometimes, you know, you'll get off stage and go, I hope the audience doesn't think I'm an asshole. What are the tricks of playing an asshole?
I don't know. And again, I say that, I'm not kidding. I'm chastened by this experience that I had of playing an asshole, not for jokes, but for real. A bad guy who said bad things. And it caused some people in the audience who were performers to complain. And I haven't figured it out. You know, again, I don't want to have anybody go to a theater, whether it's an audience member or another performer, and feel like what I did was hurt them just for a joke, right? I don't think that's a good balance. I play bad people, and what I believe in, at least for myself, whether or not it works with other people, is that bad people exist. They're probably only degrees away from good people. They certainly believe that they're justified in what they do, or that they're seeking happiness, right? So a sadist is happy, right? If I'm on stage and you know, you're limping and I'm smiling, right? And the more you suffer, the more I smile. I don't have to say I'm a bad guy. In fact, I don't even have to do a bad thing. All I got to do is smile while you go across the stage. When you're gone and I'm still smiling, I hope somebody else comes and they're crawling, And now I'm even, right? I'm even happier. And that's a bad person, right? Finding joy is can be, right? In the circumstances, can be just proof of how horrible you are.
You know, the other thing I found interesting, you said you don't consider yourself a comedian. You don't consider yourself funny. How have you been able to thrive at improv without considering yourself a comedian or being funny?
Well, first off, and, you know, I don't want to speak for you or anybody else, but, I mean, we know so many people of so many great skills. My sports analogy is that the fastest race I ever ran in college, so I was a middle distance runner, I ran the 1,500 meters, and the fastest one I ever ran, I finished second place to a guy who was so far ahead that the moment he wasn't used to was looking back over his shoulder and seeing somebody. Now, I wasn't close to him, but I was within his field of view, and I never got closer. He was a, you know, national class athlete, and I was a guy at a Division III school running the fastest race of my life. In the same way, you know, you get into comedy or improv or sketch, and you just meet people who are so talented in their character work, in their comedy, in their brilliance, you know, intellectual brilliance. And at some point, you just know, right? Like, hey, I'm contributing, but these other people just have the skills, right? And I don't think that's anything to feel bad about. I think it's just you learn yourself. And as I said, right, it's no mistake that I improvise differently now that I'm 55 than when I was 30. I like to move slower because I move slower. And I'm not going to run around and do 80 tag outs in 3 minutes. I'm just not. I could break something. So for me, right, but I think I learned something through this, right? I think I learned that there is something behind all the comedy of improvisation, all the structural brilliance of people in improv. And then there's just that sense of improvisation, that it's the at its core, it's that agreement. Let's go up there with less than what we could have. Let's take that chance together. And at the end, let's celebrate that we took the chance, whether or not it was brilliant. When it's great, it's great, right? It's even better than if you were like, yeah, boy, we did Who's On First. We did it really well, right? You get something that's nowhere near as good once it's on paper, but the moment of creating it is glorious. So for me, I look at a lot at how a lot of laughter that happens in an audience in an improv show is not laughter of comedy. It's laughter of discovery. You get an audience intrigued, and they're on the ride with you. They're thinking, what's next? And they're only a tenth of a second behind you or a second behind you. And you surprise them, but they're intrigued by you. So either they're going to be affirmed in what they believe is about to happen, and then you do it, and they love it, or they're already excited about what's going to happen next, and you do something else, and then they're surprised, and they laugh at that. And like I said, when I do shows, and even in class, two improvisers get on stage, and they've got their physical activity, and they've got some emotion, and then they make eye contact, and they sustain it for a moment, a laugh happens. They haven't even spoken yet, and a laugh happens in the group, as long as they commit to that moment, because there's an acknowledgement of who's there together, and the audience starts to lay their life experience on top of that, and they kind of get it.
You know, when you return from Los Angeles and from Phoenix, there seems to be a passion that you have returning back to Chicago. What are the things you want to accomplish as an improviser?
I really want to do this podcast.
Okay.
And now I've got that.
Okay.
I don't know what's next.
Okay. But you seem to really love teaching, and I don't remember this. I don't remember this.
Well, let's see. So in the 90s, in the early 90s, when The Annoyance was on Clark Street near Wrigley Field.
Okay.
I think, I'll get some of these facts wrong. I think Joe Bill was teaching beginning improvisation, and Mark Sutton was teaching intermediate improvisation, and Mick Napier was teaching advanced improvisation. And he was going off to direct a show at Second City, maybe his first show at Second City, and he asked me to teach advanced improvisation. So I did teach
her. What an honor that must have been. Were you intimidated or were you excited?
Both, okay. Right? And there was a time, especially right out of his class and right out of Co-Ed Prison Sluts, and at the very beginning of that time, that we talked a lot. I couldn't stop talking about improvisation. What a great person to talk about it with, right? Although I think he'd tell you now he hates nothing more than talking about improvisation.
Right.
But, and I get it. But it was, yeah, I felt so, yeah, I did feel honored, excited, scared. I inherited these students who were very good. I have found for myself that I'm able to look at a group of people and see what's missing. Not like they're wrong, but just like I can add something to this group or to individuals in this group and make the whole group better. Lately,
how do you do that?
I watch people, and it's amazing how people repeat their choices. And what I say to people is, if we're going to start with a blank stage, right, the nothing. And unless we're going to say, we're going to improvise Shakespeare, or we're going to improvise Downton Abbey, or we're going to improvise the Cubs game from today, right? That's our framework, our structure. If we're going to just do an open improvisational show, then the first thing I think we need to deliver to the audience is a journey, is variety, right? We've got this whole stage. Let's not just play the middle. We've got every energy of performance at our fingertips. Let's do them. If you do a huge energy in one scene in a very specific way, then you've opened up the whole universe of possibilities to the next scene. And it's going to feel really new because it's so different than what you did. If you just play in the middle and you just play safe, every scene gets boring, right? Repetitive. So for me, I watch people who play safe. I don't want them to do that. I watch people who just do jokes. I want emotions. I want connection on stage because, again, it's a rough estimate, but I think about 70% of scenes you're going to see in an improv show are relationship scenes, right? So a key part to me of a relationship scene is the relationship. And it's not doctor-patient. It's two people connecting emotionally and maybe not even changing, but at least revealing.
So take me, for example. I can always play. I have a habit of playing it safe. I also have a habit of playing angry, because angry is easy for me. I overdo it, I'll admit it. What would you say if you were directing me or if I was in a class of yours?
Well, sometimes what I tell people is a very practical thing. There are ways you can play that are great for one scene, that are great for three scenes. But two things happen if you play the same energy every time. Your scene partner starts to check out a little bit because you're not going to surprise them anymore, right? There's that golden moment of like, I don't know you at all, to then I do know you, so I kind of know your patterns, and now I can play off them, and I can play faster off them. That's fun. But then there's that next part where it's like, you'd better have something else, or I'm going to be like, yeah, here I am again with the guy who does the Scottish accent every time, right? And with anger, there's that. But then on top of that, we're all human. We're all vulnerable. If I play anger, even if we say like all those rules that I don't necessarily embrace about don't play judgment, don't play a teacher, don't play the boss who's just evaluating and firing, right?
Right, don't ask questions.
Right, but this particularly, that anger goes with judgment, goes with we're not going to actually connect. I'm going to be outside the scene looking at what you're doing and saying, that's no way to tap dance, right? The angry judgment character who then has nothing at stake, right? Who can't reveal any vulnerabilities.
Well, basically, he's just commenting on...
Yeah, right. So anger, on top of taking you out of the scene a lot of times, also, we're all human. If you're angry at me in a scene, I might get hurt. And I might say, that's great. I was affected by you in our show. I did a show in Phoenix with my scene partner who, at the end of a very emotional set, spit in my face. And I talk about that as really an amazing moment. He chose to do it. He didn't do it to me as the performer, right? We got there. And if I want to say it that way, I'd earned it, right? Or we had earned it. And it was pretty amazing, pretty shocking, but it was true to the moment. But let's say I play that guy every time, the guy who deserves to be spit in the face.
Right.
At some point, my scene partners are like, that's not actually fun. Right.
So what would you say to me if I was playing that guy who was angry all the time and spit in your face?
I would say, all right, that's great. The next scene out, in the same way that I tell people, what was the last scene? You know, people are worried about, how do I come up with an idea for my scene? sometimes it's easier to say, let's do like the Monty Python expression. I think I wrote it down. And now for something completely different, right? If I see a scene in a show that's huge and loud, I know it would be great to do a quiet scene. If they're running around or if they're occupying the whole stage, I know I'm going to get right next to my scene partner. And we're going to play a tiny scene, maybe quiet, maybe very peaceful. And it's going to be such a jarring change from the last scene. That's that notion of variety. Like, here's why we start with a blank slate, because we could do anything and we're going to really take you on a ride. And so I say that too to the performer, right? So there's the scene before, but there's also the scene you did before. What did you do in the show already, right? How can you surprise the audience? And for some people, it's like, oh, well, I've got my two characters, and I joke in class that I'm either loud and angry or loud, angry, and drunk. I do a little more than that. I'm a little broader than that. But the idea that at least you better think about expanding your character choices and your emotional choices. So if you're playing angry a lot, I would say, fine, do an angry scene. The next scene, don't. Right? That's easy. Because now you just say, okay, what's not angry? And you don't have to own the universe. You just have to own one choice that's not angry.
I could play a shy character.
Right. And so now, on top of everything else, at the end of your 30 minutes or whatever your set is, you've played vulnerable. You've given somebody else the lead in the scene, if you want to evaluate it that way. I'm not big into evaluating mid-scene. You know, people teach improvisation as a set of rules or structural order of events. I just kind of think you do it. And afterwards, maybe you think about it and you add up like, okay, how many times was I angry? And how many times did I... was I the boss or was I the powerful character versus how many times was I not? How many times was I, the loser, the weak character? How many times did I fawn on my scene partner and just admire them and just, you know, look to them to validate me and need it? And, you know, I'm weak. And I need that for my scene partner, my character scene partner, right? And so then at least I'm saying in a night, what did I do? What do I want to do next that's different? And when I walk off stage, hopefully I've done three different things, four different things.
And what will you tell yourself in the next show? What will you say to yourself before you go on? Is there things you've planned out? Like, I'm going to... Look, I did a lot of angry last week. It's going to be more, I'm going to do sad, I'm going to do shy, I'm going to be more vulnerable.
Sometimes. I'm not a big planner. Or like I said, maybe I think about it and I think about strategies, but then I want to forget them. Because when I got on stage, I don't want to be in my head. And when I watch improvisers who, you can tell, right? You can tell when somebody's like, well, my goal this week was to not speak in such long sentences because you mentioned that in class. Okay, cool. Did you have fun? No. How were my scenes? Bad. Right? Now, you could say, well, a student jam or a class show is still practice as much as it is performance. But I think if we work hard enough offstage, then onstage is where we have fun, right? So I don't, if I really think I have I need to focus on something or I'm going to have a bad show, then I'll do it, right? If I know who I'm performing with and I'm like, I know certain things really will make this better, then not. Then maybe I'll... Right? Increase my focus on those things that are going to be instrumental to a good show, to a fun show. But that's the goal, right? Is to have fun. And so too many rules or too many measurements other than just the spontaneous discovery aren't helping me have fun, right? And checking off the box saying, yeah, I came here and I said, I'm going to play less angry. Okay, that's fine. For me, again, I would be more like, okay, I just want to play different things. When I'm stepping out of a scene, I'm going to think about for a moment what I did. I'm going to think about what might be different the next time. Because, you know, you're going to jump off the wall however you do your show. And you'll have that moment of choice. And so you can choose, like, okay, even though I'm going to discover what's out here, I'm going to start happier. I'm just going to be happier, right? I have learned for myself certain physical postures that support me in certain emotional states, or they imply a part way to a character. I love to do that because it makes it easier, right? And I sometimes teach this, and for some people it works, and for some people it doesn't, to say, yeah, if I play upright, It's interesting. Upright's very interesting. For some people, it's stiff and it's authoritarian. For me, I get up on the balls of my feet and I'm a little floaty. And I feel like a very light character. And it really informs all my choices after that. So that, to me, is like, what an easy path to at least the bare bones of a character. And so if I have played an angry character, that might be a way I go to just lighten up.
We got to wrap this up. This has been so fascinating. Yes, we do, Bob.
All right, it's part one, everybody.
It's part one. We always end the podcast the same way. What one piece of advice would you give to an improviser starting out today?
Oh, man. I'll say this. I grew up in Chicagoland, so I didn't travel far for school. And I didn't move to Chicago for Second City or I.O. or anything. In fact, like I said, I got very lucky in getting there. It's amazing how much talent is in Chicago. When I was a kid, or when I was that young improviser, I really thought it was about learning the forms and the structures and the rules, and that everybody was good because they were learning the structures and the rules. And I underappreciated all the talent that I was surrounded by. And I look back at the people I got to perform with. It's amazing, right? And I'm sure you feel the same way.
Yeah.
And so that's what I would say, is that, you know, in this world right now where improvisers somehow have formed a pattern where they're running from show to show, and they have five shows a night, and they can't stay because they got another one to do. And if they're at I.O., they're going to run to the crowd. And if they're at Annoyance, they're going to run to the playground, and et cetera, right? Take a moment. Take a moment and appreciate the people that you're working with right now, that you're playing with right now, that you're studying with right now. Get to know their names. Get to know who they are. Because they are wildly more talented than you appreciate right now. They're going to go amazing places. So are you. Hopefully together. And I think that would help to make the most of this moment.
Bob Fisher, thank you for being our guest.
Thank you very much.
That was great, great, great.
Thank you. I had a great time.
And there you have it. Another great episode of Improv Nerd is in the can. And wasn't Bob just amazing? If that isn't a masterclass, I don't know what isn't. So I want to thank my guest, Bob Fisher, for recording this at my home here in Evanston. I'm going to say our studio here in Evanston. I'd like to thank my producer, Dan Schiffmacher. He's the one who makes me sound so slick and so professional. And also Sam Bowers, who is the director of Improv Nerd. And I also want to thank my wife, Lauren Corain, for helping me with the questions, preparing the questions. If you want more information about me, Jimmy Corain, and my award-winning improv workshops, intensives, and classes, go to my website, jimmycorain.com, and sign up for the Improv Nerd newsletter. Each week, I will send out a new blog that will help you become a better improviser and a better person. Well, the better person part is up to you. Also, I want to let you know we are on social media. So follow us on all the great social medias, right? That would be Facebook. We have an Improv Nerd Facebook page. Like us because it really helps with my low self-esteem. Also, follow us on Twitter, improv_nerd. And then go to our wonderful YouTube channel where you'll see clips from our live show. We are also part of this wonderful podcast collective called feralaudio.com. So go and check out all their great podcasts. And also to help us out, to support not only this podcast, the other podcasts, you can go to feralaudio.com. And just if you want to buy something from Amazon, they have a buy now page or a buy portal, I think they call it. So just click on that and then we'll get a couple pennies our way and Feral will get some money their way. And it just helps everybody out. So go to that. That's really, really helpful. I want to thank you for listening. And until next time, remember, walk, don't run.
Hello, I'm Kyle Ayers. I'm the host of Never Seen It, the podcast where comedians rewrite famous movies and TV shows they've never seen, and then we give them a read in studio. This is a clip I want to play for you guys from an episode where Langston Kerman rewrites Scarface. He's never seen it, but he wrote a script based on what he thinks he knows about it. And here's a clip. Give it a listen.
All right. Scarface, The New Frontier. Interior, happening discotheque. Remember when we called clubs discotheques? LOL. The 70s were crazy. Night. The crowd bustles with young, hot Mexicans who are supposed to be Cuban and all are dressed in butterfly collared shirts and pants that look like JNCO jeans and pleated khakis had a really weird baby. There's sex in the air and Poppy wants a whiff.
Oh my God.
Scarface, 22 to 45.
Like he's a television audience demographic.
Devilishly handsome, not even a little bit Italian looking, so get that out of your dumb brain. Walks through the crowd with the confidence of a man who's going on MTV Cribs with the Ying Yang Twins one day. Does he actually have a scar on his face? Fuck no. Why would you even ask that? That's not important. What's important is that he is not at all a problematic stereotype and that he has come for his cocaine. As he approaches the red rope of the VIP, pronounced Ve A Pay in Spanish,
oh my gosh.
He spots his dear friend who is almost certainly going to become his enemy by the end of the film, Smooth Skin. Scarface yells out his signature line.
Ciao, Bella. It's me, Scarface.